content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today, Censorship Comes for Stephen Colbert. The latest dust-up between the talk show host and CBS should be concerning for people of any political leaning. Written by David A. Graham, and this is an edition of The Atlantic Daily, a newsletter that guides you through the biggest stories of the day, helps you discover new ideas, and recommends the best in culture. Stephen Colbert's Late Show ends in May, and he's in almost open warfare with his soon-to-be ex-bosses at CBS. Recently, he planned to broadcast an interview with James Tallarico, a member of the Texas State House, who is running in a heated Democratic primary for United States Senate. But it was not meant to be. At the start of his show, Colbert told viewers that CBS had barred him from airing the interview, citing threats from Brendan Carr, the chair of the Federal Communication Commission. You may remember Carr as the guy who sounded like a cartoon mobster while trying to get Jimmy Kimmel fired. We can do this the easy way or the hard way. Drawing a rebuke from Senator Ted Cruz. Colbert savaged CBS. He said that the network had told him not to talk about it, which he defied in dramatic fashion. I want to assure you, ladies and gentlemen, please, I want to assure you, this decision is for purely financial reasons, he joked, a sly reference to the rationale that CBS gave for ending his show. Colbert posted the interview on his show's YouTube channel. CBS said in a statement that The Late Show was not prohibited by CBS from broadcasting the interview with Representative James Tallarico. The show was provided legal guidance that the broadcast could trigger the FCC equal time rule for the other two candidates, including Representative Jasmine Crockett, and presented options for how the equal time for other candidates could be fulfilled. I wrote in July that CBS's leadership had lost the benefit of the doubt, and that the network's actions since its parent company's merger with Skydance and the appointment of Barry Weiss as the editor-in-chief of CBS News have reinforced that. CBS deserves plenty of criticism for cowardice, but that doesn't mean it's incorrect to fear FCC action. Last month, the FCC issued a notice about the Equal Time Rule, a century-old regulation that says a broadcast station that provides time to one candidate must provide an equal forum to a rival. The rule has an exemption for, quote, bona fide news, end quote. Basically, producers can decide what to cover in their programming, because anything else would constitute government interference in the free press. In 2006, the FCC determined that interviews on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno fit under the exemption, even if they were not strictly news programming, a precedent that shows have relied on since. But the new notice states that the FCC has not been presented with any evidence that the interview portion of any late-night or daytime television talk show program on air presently would qualify for a bona fide news exemption. Carr has not extended this reasoning to talk radio, which conservatives dominate. This is not just bluster. Earlier this month, Fox News reported that the FCC was investigating ABC's daytime talk show The View, which has become an important stop for politicians seeking to reach the show's heavily female audience, for violating the equal time rule. The reported object of Carr's ire? An interview with one James Tallarico. The Tallarico dust-ups are among several incidents in the past few days that show the Trump administration's enthusiasm for censoring speech by both the press and ordinary citizens. 1 year ago, I wrote that Donald Trump and his allies were free speech phonies who, having campaigned against censorship, were eager to impose it. The threat to First Amendment rights has gotten worse since then. Earlier this month, The Washington Post's John Woodrow Cox reported on a retiree who used a publicly available email address to encourage an attorney at the Department of Homeland Security to have mercy on an asylum seeker. In response, DHS sent federal agents to the man's door and demanded access to his Google accounts using a tool called an administrative subpoena that doesn't require a judge or grand jury to approve. On Friday, the New York Times reported that Google, Reddit, Discord, and Meta in recent months have received hundreds of administrative subpoenas from DHS seeking access to information about the accounts of people who have criticized the government. DHS told both papers that it was acting within its authority but didn't give any detailed response. The goals of both DHS and the FCC in these cases are to intimidate critics and stifle dissent. This is staggering hypocrisy. During the presidential campaign, Trump accused the Biden administration of undermining free speech by asking, though not demanding, that social media companies remove misinformation about COVID. On day one of his administration, Trump issued an executive order that charged, "Over the past 4 years, the previous administration trampled free speech rights by censoring American speech on online platforms, often by exerting substantial coercive pressure on third parties, such as social media companies, to moderate, deplatform, or otherwise suppress speech that the federal government did not approve." This is a good description of what Trump's administration is doing now. Some repression efforts fail. Last week, the federal district court judge Richard Leon, a President George W. Bush appointee, temporarily blocked Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth from punishing Senator Mark Kelly, a Navy veteran, for a video in which he and other members of Congress remind current service members that they can and should refuse illegal orders. This court has all it needs to conclude that defendants have trampled on Senator Kelly's First Amendment freedoms and threatened the constitutional liberties of millions of military retirees, Leon wrote. The ruling is a welcome defense of America's freedoms, but it can't reverse all of the damage. Kelly is unusually well positioned to fight back and take the administration to court. Not every would-be critic is. And censorship, once established by a president, has ways of spreading its tendrils to other institutions. At one state university in Texas, for example, a philosophy professor was forced to remove passages of Plato from his syllabus because of new policies passed by governor-appointed regents. And the art exhibition critical of ICE was abruptly canceled at another Texas university. These attacks are clearly partisan. They all target speech by critics of the president, his party, or his policies. But they should be scary even if you feel that Colbert doesn't deserve a news exemption. The View is too liberal, or Kelly was out of line. Crackdowns on speech by prominent figures pave a way for the government to regulate speech more broadly, which should be concerning for people of any political leaning because the party and people in power can change. During a Senate hearing last week, Senator Ron Johnson, a Wisconsin Republican, accused Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison, a Democrat, of being responsible for the deaths of Alex Pretty and Renee Good because he supported protests. Johnson began, "Did you ever encourage people to go out there and exercise the First? I freely admit in being in favor of the First Amendment," Ellison shot back. "This position is apparently not as common among elected officials as you might hope." Our second story, "The Blurry Line Between Protein Bar and Candy Bar," written by Nicholas Florco. Eating candy for breakfast is not a good decision, But most mornings, I start my day with something that looks and tastes a lot like just that. The Built Puff Protein Bar is covered in chocolate and has a sweet coconut center, making it practically indistinguishable from a Mounds bar. Nutritionally, though, the two products are very different. A Mounds bar has north of 200 calories and 20 grams of added sugar. My bar has 140 calories, just 6 grams of added sugar, and about as much protein as 3 eggs. Protein bars have come a long way from the chalky monstrosities that lined shelves not long ago. In this era of protein everything, they are successfully spoofing candy, but with much more impressive macronutrients. Built also makes bars in flavors such as Blue Razz Blast, Strawberries and Cream, and Banana Cream Pie, all with a similar nutritional profile to my preferred coconut version. Another one of my favorites, the Bear Bells Caramel Cashew Bar, tastes like a mashup of a Twix and a Snickers. There are Rocky Road protein bars, birthday cake protein bars coated in sprinkles, and snickerdoodle-flavored protein bars. In theory, I can eat frosted cinnamon rolls or a package of sour gummies without blowing my diet. For anyone with a sweet tooth, it can feel like food companies have developed guilt-free candy. But that's where things get disorienting. Some of these products are seemingly nutritionally benign, whereas others are nothing more than junk food trying to cash in on protein's good reputation. The new protein-spiked Pop-Tarts contain the same amount of sugar as the original Pop-Tarts, 30 grams. Or consider Gatorade's Protein Bar, which has roughly as much sugar as a full-size Snickers. At this point, the line between the protein bar and the candy bar has never been blurrier. If you're confused, you're not the only one. In 2023, a group of Gatorade customers sued PepsiCo, the brand's parent company, over its sugary protein bars. They alleged that Gatorade was deceiving customers by labeling the products as protein bars as opposed to, quote, a candy bar or dessert, end quote. Pepsi's lawyers said it had not engaged in false advertising because the sugar content was right there for anyone to see on the Nutrition Facts label. In October, the case against PepsiCo was resolved out of court. The bars are still loaded with sugar. The lawyers have a point. For some bars, the Nutrition Facts do tell a clear story. You don't need to be a nutritionist to figure out that protein Pop-Tarts are not particularly good for you. Other cases, however, aren't that simple. An oatmeal raisin walnut Clif bar tastes pretty healthy, and its 10 grams of protein may keep you fuller for a while. One of the many reasons people are protein maxing these days. But is it worth 14 grams of added sugar? Calories and sugar only tell you so much about whether you're munching on a healthy snack or something that's more akin to a Butterfinger. Consider the FDA's advice on the matter. The agency used to say a protein bar could be classified as healthy if it provided at least 10% of a person's daily recommended protein and also didn't have much fat, cholesterol, or sodium. Under these guidelines, most of these new bars would qualify as healthy. But the FDA finalized those guidelines in 2024 after complaints from Kind, which makes bars studded with whole nuts. The company argued that the rules unfairly maligned its products because nuts are too high in fat to qualify as healthy. Under the new rules, it seems that protein bars and other products can't be labeled as healthy if they rely on protein powders and isolates rather than whole foods such as nuts and eggs for their protein. As a result, many modern protein bars probably can't be labeled as healthy. The FDA is onto something, according to many nutritionists. Protein bars are candy bars in disguise, Marion Nestle, an emeritus professor of nutrition at NYU, told me. But even products like David bars, which come in flavors such as cake batter and red velvet, and have just 150 calories and 0 grams of sugar, are not as healthy as they may seem. They are made with artificial sweeteners and several other food additives, as are many other candy protein hybrids with impressive macros, including my beloved coconut-flavored Built Puff. These bars lack the slew of micronutrients such as vitamins and minerals that are typically part of whole foods. Eat a bag of nuts and you will be healthier and get your protein. Barry Popkin, a nutrition professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, told me. Like candy, most modern protein bars are squarely in the category of ultra-processed foods, which many researchers believe may prompt people to overeat and contribute to our collective dietary problems. The science of ultra-processed foods remains largely speculative, however. It's not yet clear just how bad these products are for us and why. In an email, David, CEO, Peter Rahal, told me that the macronutrients are what matter most. To call David a candy bar because it tastes good is like calling a Tesla a toy because it's fun to drive, he said. At the very least, something like the David bar is probably better than a Snickers for anyone craving a quick snack. If protein bars truly replace candy, perhaps Americans will be marginally healthier. If these products become people's breakfast instead of a well-balanced meal, then not so much. The protein boom has made it easier than ever to get your macros from fun, tasty treats. But for the most part, they are still just treats. Next, the worst case future for white-collar workers. This is written by Annie Lowry. White-collar workers are getting nervous, with good reason. Sure, 98% of college graduates who want a job still have one, and wages are ticking up. Sure, some companies that cite the labor-saving, efficiency-promoting effects of ChatGPT and Claude as they let employers go are just AI washing, talking about algorithms to distract from poor managerial decisions. But the labor market for office workers is beginning to shift. Americans with a bachelor's degree account for a quarter of the unemployed, a record. High school graduates are finding jobs quicker than college graduates, an unprecedented trend. Occupations susceptible to AI automation have seen sharp spikes in joblessness. Businesses are really shrinking payroll and cutting costs as they deploy AI. In recent weeks, Baker McKenzie, a white shoe law firm, axed 700 employees. Salesforce sacked hundreds of workers, and the auditing firm KPMG negotiated lower fees with its own auditor. Two CNBC reporters with no engineering experience vibe-coded a clone of Monday.com's workflow management platform in less than an hour. When they released their story, Monday.com stock tanked. Maybe algorithm-driven changes will happen slowly, giving workers plenty of time to adjust. Maybe white-collar types have 12 to 18 months left. Maybe the AI-related job carnage will be contained to a sliver of the economy. Maybe we should be more worried about a stock market bubble than an AI-driven labor revolution. I don't think anyone knows what will happen or even what is happening now. AI technology is changing at an exponential pace and changing the workforce in thousands hard-to-parse ways. But if AI quickly eliminates white-collar work, the country is going to end up in something much stranger than a downturn and something much harder to recover from, too. The United States is adept at enough at handling the labor market damage caused by recessions. Congress slashes taxes, writes stimulus checks, and fattens unemployment insurance payouts. Washington amps up infrastructure spending and patches hole in the budgets of state and local governments. The Federal Reserve drops interest rates down to zero and purchases hundreds of billions of dollars of safe assets, making borrowing cheaper for families and encouraging businesses to invest. Demand increases, pushing the unemployment rate down and GDP up. But if white-collar layoffs cause a downturn, Washington might not be able to restore hiring and lift consumer spending as it has done before. Businesses wouldn't need the skills workers possess. Firms wouldn't want to hire the legions of accountants, engineers, lawyers, middle managers, human resource executives, financial analysts, PR types, and customer service agents they just laid off. Writers would be fine, I choose to believe. The United States would have a structural unemployment problem, as economists put it, not a cyclical demand problem. The country has struggled with structural joblessness in the past, but the problem has tended to afflict blue-collar workers, not white-collar ones. The labor market is normally womb-like in the security it delivers the college-educated. The downsizing trend of the 1990s did not actually result in the pool of office jobs shrinking. Even during the Great Recession, the unemployment rate for workers with a bachelor's degree never went higher than 5.3%. For workers with only an associate's degree or some college credits, it hit 9%. For workers with only a high school diploma, 11.9%. In this new economic paradigm, the educated and well-to-do would fare worse than their less educated and lower-income neighbors. The main bulwark against joblessness, the unemployment insurance system, wouldn't meet the challenge. Payments last for only so long, 6 months at most currently, 18 months during the coronavirus pandemic. If AI eliminated the need for office work, many people would be unemployed for years. Their earnings would potentially fall, their mental health would deteriorate, and their chance of finding a new position would diminish with every month that passed. Plus, the unemployment system isn't designed to support six-figure earners. Most state payments max out at $500 or $600 a week, a quarter of what many upper-middle-class employers earn. Young workers would face their own challenges. The pool of entry-level white-collar jobs would shrink, as it already is, pushing recent graduates' income down for years, even decades. If rich households cut back on spending, many businesses that have nothing to do with AI, grocery stores, gas stations, retail shops, hairdressers, restaurants, would suffer and the labor market would keep deteriorating. The housing market would begin to falter. Home prices in many regions would fall and fewer properties would go to market. Tax revenue might fall. Bond yields might go up as the country's deficits increased, making it harder for the Fed to stimulate investment. Rank-and-file workers' incomes would drop at the same time that executives using AI to cut costs would see their wealth increase. Inequality would rise to even higher heights. The 0.01% would pull away from the 0.1%. which would pull away from the 1%. White-collar workers would go through what blue-collar workers went through beginning in the 1970s. Advances in machine technology improved productivity and depressed employment in Detroit, Pittsburgh, Gary, Indiana, and Worcester, Massachusetts. Rust Belt communities fell apart and never recovered. Then China joined the World Trade Organization, and globalization spurred another round of job losses, causing even more permanent damage. Affected workers ended up poorer, less happy, and less healthy. They died sooner. Their kids were worse off, too. To get the economy going again during the AI transition, the country would need to figure out how to get white-collar workers back to work. And I really mean figure out, essentially from scratch. Existing workforce training initiatives have yielded muted and inconclusive results. Existing displaced worker initiatives have dubious value. These kinds of programs offer net negative value to participants, taxpayers, and society as a whole, studies have found. community college programs have the strongest track record. But the overwhelming majority of office workers have a two-year or four-year degree already. The country doesn't have answers that don't involve upskilling, education, or trying and failing to compensate the losers. Silicon Valley leaders are enamored of one policy, Hail Mary, the establishment of a universal basic income, in which the government would provide all adults with $1,500 a month or so, no strings attached, and in perpetuity. It's not as crazy an idea as it sounds. Think of it as Social Security for everyone, or an extension of the earned income tax credits to families without any earned income. The cash would ensure that every family kept its head above water and redistribute the wealth generated by rising productivity. People will be freed up to spend more time with people they care about, care for people, appreciate art and nature, or work toward social good, Sam Altman of OpenAI has argued. But UBI is a dystopian outcome, not a utopian one. For families to thrive in this new post-work paradigm, the government would need to distribute a lot more than $1,500 per person per month, necessitating confiscatory taxes on corporations, taxes they would fight tooth and nail. The bigger problem would be that Americans would hate a world without work, where the jobless rate floats at 30% instead of 4%. Many Americans like working. They like having somewhere to go during the day. They like trading water cooler stories with their colleagues. They like getting promoted and starting their own firms. They are proud of earning a living. Long-term unemployment destroys people's mental and physical health and generates toxic societal unrest. Politicians love saying that Americans want a hand up, not a hand out. And they aren't wrong. Perhaps Americans would adjust and American culture would adjust in turn. Maybe people would become more interested in and fulfilled by leisure, art, and other activities. But it's hard to imagine the country becoming more egalitarian and its politics more participatory instead of developing a hyper-wealthy techno-oligarchy and a dispossessed and teed-off underclass. Some people would spend their time gardening, volunteering, painting, exercising, or learning. Others would spend hours a day watching short-form videos and never leave their apartments. I don't really think society will come to this. Throughout history, people have used technology to become more productive and prosperous without reducing the demand for human labor overall. Then again, maybe I'm just in denial. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.com. ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.